Tonight I want to look at the study we've got in the life of the kings of Israel. We started and we saw part of the division underneath the rule of Solomon when we had the division of the kingdom underneath and to the hands of Rehoboam and Jeroboam. I want then to read 1 Kings chapter 14 and verse 14 and 15. Moreover, the Lord shall raise him up a king over Israel who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam that day. But what? Even now. For the Lord shall smite Israel as a reed is shaken in the water, and he shall root up Israel out of this good land which he gave to their fathers, and shall scatter them beyond the river, because they have made their groves, provoking the Lord to anger. And he shall give Israel up because of the sins of Jeroboam who did sin, and who made Israel to sin. As I said, we're standing at the head of this division of the line of kings, a division of the nation and a division of the people. And in our study, we do need to maintain a good pace because we have much ground to cover. And we don't want to be absorbed unnecessarily, however attractive such a diversion might be. We don't want to be too absorbed with the interesting and the characters and events of all the details of all and every reign. We have no external structure to set us in our study. We're not looking at a book. We're not looking at a theological theme or doctrine. We're not looking at a character. We're looking at the place of the prophets in the line of the kings and in the history of the nation, so that we've got a broad overview and a broad picture of where these things fit in. Where does Joel come? And to whom is he speaking? Who is this man, Obadiah? And where does he come in the time scale, and what is his message, and to whom of the people? And so therefore we need to be pacey in what we're doing. But we also must pause over incidents and events which cast a long shadow over our study and are crucial points in our study. And such an event is the meeting behind and involving the prophet Ahijah and the queen, Jeroboam's wife. We need to slow down. We need to revisit again the rule of this king. And we need to look at the specific emphasis that it gives to us and the example that he sets for us. This man's rule starts with such a bright promise given to us in chapter 11 and verse 35. But I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand, and I will give it unto you, even the 10 tribes. And unto his son will I give one tribe, that David, my servant, may have a light always before me in Jerusalem, the city which I have chosen me to put my name there. And I will take thee, and thou shalt reign according to all that thy soul desireth, and shall be king over Israel. And it shall be, if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command thee, and wilt walk in my ways, and do that which is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, that I will be with thee, and build thee a sure house, as I built for David, and will give Israel unto thee. These are the words which describe for us the bright promise that is before Jeroboam. But so soon, in fact, just after one generation, just after a matter of years, that bright promise is reduced to a bleak prospect. Verse 14 of chapter 14, the verse we read, "Moreover, the Lord shall raise him a king over Israel, who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam that day." So therefore, let us pause and come back down to this crucial and decisive meeting between Ahijah and the Queen. And I want to look at three or four simple headings that will help us to understand this event and what happened in it, lessons from it, and the shadow it casts into the future and on our study. First of all, I want us to think of the approach that we see here with these characters. At the beginning of chapter 14, we are told of the problem that there was in the palace. At that time, Abijah, the son of Jeroboam, fell sick. There was a cloud in the royal house. The son and heir was sick and dying. And there was more than just the personal family concerns and interests displayed and involved here. This was the house of Jeroboam. And the dynasty, the successive lines that were spoken of in that prophecy that was given earlier on in chapter 11, the successive lines there hangs on the survival of this sick son. Jeroboam, he has created the infrastructure of idols and of temples and of priests. He has given to them the trappings of idolatry, of false idolatry. For the people, he has deluded them with a false peace. He has given to them a worthless substitute. And he's done it to keep them from wandering. To keep them from looking over the shoulder, looking over the boundary. To keep them from going back again to the place of worship and the things that were going on in Judah to the south. What an irony then. For all of the infrastructure that he's created and all of the things that he's provided for the people, the question we ask ourselves is this: did it work? Did it work for his son and for himself? No doubt he would have tried these things for himself, tried them for his son. But we know that it would all have drawn a blank. His son was still ill. Yes, the people were deluded. But when it comes down to the wire, when the problems are real, deep, intense, and personal, when the problems come close to home, when the problems become personal as they were for Jeroboam and his son being ill, then Jeroboam wants something that works. It wasn't to Dan, and it wasn't to Beersheba that he went. It was to Shiloh and to the council of the prophet. It was about 30 miles, no great journey for his wife to take and to make to go there to consult the prophet. The people may be satisfied with, the people might be deluded by the many false teachings in the comfortable society, but when the back is to the wall, in a tight corner, they want something real and satisfying. They've tried the rest. Now they've got to try the best. We can see that sometimes translated and applying to our own society. Somebody who is hostile, someone who is intense in their anti-Christian position and point of view, and they kick over all that we might say to them and lay before them. They might be very vocal in their criticism, even violent in their words against us. But then, when the problem comes close to them, like it came close to Jeroboam, all of these past criticisms, suddenly they are lost sight of. And that person today might want that particular Christian or that particular minister who has been faithful in witnessing to them and who for all of these years was the sharp end of their tongue, now they are the one that they want. They are the one that they're looking for. Jeroboam had been denying and defying the word of God. Now he's wanting to take counsel from the prophet of God. We can easily understand why he went to and sought the counsel of this prophet Ahijah. If you go back again to chapter 11:35, you find there that there was clear counsel and warning given to him, to Jeroboam, that he must walk in the ways of the Lord, and the consequences of not doing so were clearly spelt out for him. And he was left in no doubt what was required of him. And again, when you come into chapter 13, and when the man of God out of Judah came to confront Jeroboam and spoke to him of the consequences of the way in which he was setting himself up as a priest and installing all the infrastructure of idolatry, and the man of God gave him clear and plain warning of what would happen to him, Jeroboam stretched out his hand and pointed to him, almost to say, "Arrest that man." And just as he was putting up his hand and pointing out his finger, his hand froze, his arm froze. And suddenly he was more concerned with his own health than the restoration of his own strength. And so he then asks the prophet. The king answered and said, I'm reading now from chapter 13, verse 6. And the king answered and said unto the man of God, entreat now the face of the Lord thy God, and pray for me, that my hand may be restored me again. And the man of God besought the Lord, and the king's hand was restored him again, and became as it was before. So there we have Jeroboam confronted with the power of prayer and the demonstration of the sovereignty of God. There we have the Lord establishing his credentials with Jeroboam. So there was no difficulty understanding why he wanted to turn to Ahijah. But he held on to a superstitious approach. The first element in their approach, in his approach to the king, it was a superstitious approach. His arm froze. The prophet prayed. His arm was restored. Well, if it happened like that in chapter 13, well, perhaps it might happen like that in chapter 14. He held on to this mechanical, superstitious approach, being a stranger to the personal relationship with God which the prophet had, which he lacked. The superstitious approach. And of course, on top of all of that superstition, he was always ready to heap a little bit of physical encouragement. Give the prophet a little bit of bread. Give him a little jar of honey. The old saying of greasing the palm comes to mind. The first element of their approach, the king's approach, superstitious approach. But it continues also in the same approach application in the behavior of the queen. The queen, in her approach, went in disguise. Why did she go in disguise? Why did she not go plainly open up front as the queen of Jeroboam? Well, can we suggest, first of all, that it was because of political realities. If the people saw what was happening, if the people saw the queen going not to Dan or to Beersheba, if the people saw the queen going to Shiloh, then immediately the whole reputation and the infrastructure that Jeroboam had established would be under question, would possibly quite likely be ruined. There was a danger of inconsistency coming right at the very center of the religious life that he had established in the land of Israel. We've got to go to Dan, said the people. Why doesn't she go to Dan? Why does she go to Shiloh? Confidence in what he had created, in the faults would be crumbling. Political reality. But on top of that political reality, there is also another element of her approach, self-preservation. Why did the queen go and not Jeroboam? Why her, not him? And again, when you go back to the meeting in chapter 11 and verse 38, the meeting between Ahijah and Jeroboam, then that conversation sets out very clearly, as we've already indicated, the path which Jeroboam had to take. There was a solemn warning given of the consequences of disobedience. Time has now passed. Jeroboam has gone down the path he chose and done what he wanted. He has now set up all of this structure of worshipping false idols, these golden calves, these bulls. He's done all of that in Israel. Now that he's done it, what kind of sermon do you think Ahijah would give him, knowing what he's done? What kind of talking to would he get from the prophet if he went himself pleading for his son? The best thing to do would be to hide. And so instead of going himself, he sends his wife. The approach, the superstitious approach of himself, the disguise of the queen, for political reality, for self-preservation. And surely we can see there the warning for ourselves. We have a saying, we're familiar with it perhaps, when we describe our commitment to the Lord, it must be, the Lord is Lord of all, or he is not at all. The Lord is Lord of all, or he is not Lord at all. We cannot put God into pigeonholes. We cannot put him into a little aspect, application, and dimension of our lives and leave the rest of our lives sanitized, protected from his influence or his claims. We cannot have our God as a servant to whom we can turn only in times of need, but for the rest of our lives we disregard and leave him to the side. That is what Jeroboam wanted to do. Yes, he would turn to God in the crisis of family illness for his son's good health and well-being. But in the ordinary everyday affairs of life, he was going to get on himself and do his own thing, have his own idols, have his own life enjoyed as he did to the full. So then, he wanted the blessings, but he didn't want the commands, instructions, the micro details which the Lord has for every one of his people. The first thing then, the approach that these two characters had, king and queen, Jeroboam and his wife, in their problem. But the second thing I want to draw attention to is not only the approach, but I want us also to think of the way in which they were ambushed. We can all understand and we can easily enter into the emotions of the queen as she went on her way, because she would have gone not just as a queen, but she would have gone as a mother with a very heavy heart, concerned about her boy. But as she came towards the home of the prophet Ahijah, and as she came into this company, the Lord addressed a much broader canvas and picture. The message that she was given and the talk that Ahijah gave went beyond the family concerns and interests. It went out to the nation, the people, and it journeyed down time for several, many generations and five dynasties. Ambushed. We can think of a similar situation in the life of Moses. The three phases of 40 years which summarize his life, and the Lord taking him out of the class of the Egyptian riches into the riches of another class of the dependence upon the Lord he had to exhibit and learn in the backside of the desert. And when the class was almost over and the bell was going for the end of the class, what do we find but a burning bush? And it was curiosity that made Moses turn aside to see why it was not being burnt and consumed by the fire. Curiosity brought him there, and when he arrived there, the Lord ambushed him in that curiosity and spoke to him of his purpose. Same here. The queen was ambushed, and the prophet spoke. First of all, she was accosted. The best of plans, no doubt, were made for her traveling and for her disguise. She came from the gifts that she brought with her. We can conclude that she came dressed and with the provisions of a poor woman. She came, no doubt, with minute attention to detail, seeking to deceive and to fool anyone. They would have approached things quite simply. They were able to deceive just an old man. They would have thought, well, it's only one old man that we're dealing with here. We'll easily be able to deceive him. No problems. We'll easily outsmart him. But they did not realize who they were dealing with. They did not realize who they were relating to. We've got to remind ourselves and constantly hold it before our minds what 2 Chronicles 16 and verse 9 tells us. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in the behalf of those whose heart is perfect towards him. Herein thou hast done foolishly, therefore from henceforth thou shalt have wars. There we are told a very simple practical truth. The eyes of the Lord run to and fro over the face of the earth. He misses nothing. Not just simply the outward acts that we do, but the Lord also is thoroughly familiar with the inner motives and thoughts behind and below these outward acts. She was accosted. She was ambushed. And yet, we can see the wonder of that sovereignty. Neither sight nor sound was needed. The prophet Ahijah was suffering from blindness of old age. He had cataracts, could well be so. He wasn't able to see, he couldn't see who was coming before him. He didn't need her to speak and to possibly recognize her voice. The Lord was ahead of her. The Lord was there speaking already to Ahijah, preparing him to speak to her. This episode and this text, the one that's given to us here in verse 5, and the Lord said unto Ahijah, behold, the wife of Jeroboam cometh. And then in verse 6, and it was so when Ahijah heard the sound of her feet as she came in at the door that he said, come in, thou wife of Jeroboam. Why findest thou thyself to be another? For I am sent to thee with heavy tidings. Spurgeon quotes an example of this where one man was converted under his ministry and was attending the tabernacle regularly. His wife was not interested, in a measure hostile, but curiosity one time got the better of her, and she wanted to hear what Spurgeon was saying himself. And so after her husband left to go to the chapel, she got ready to go to the tabernacle also. Because she was later and going away, she wasn't there at the beginning of the service, but she got there eventually just as the preacher Spurgeon was announcing the text. And the text that night was this very one, Come in, thou wife of Jeroboam, why feignest thou thyself to be another? And through that word, the Lord spoke powerfully to that woman. And when she went home and she told what had happened, she was almost ready to, she was in fact blaming her husband for priming Spurgeon as to what was going on, because she felt that the words were so personal and close to herself. But how was he to know? He had been away before she left. The only explanation that we have and we can give is that the Lord knows, and the Lord prepared Spurgeon, and the Lord prepared Ahijah, and the Lord ambushed both who had come to hear his word. Well, she was accosted. But the second thing we see here is that she was accused. Again, the prophet takes time and gives us the details of the charge sheet against her and Jeroboam. The Lord, speaking through the prophet, speaks and says it very clearly. I did this, and I did that, and I did the next thing for you. I took the kingdom out of the house of David, and I gave it to you, and I made this, and I did that, and I exalted you. Wave after wave of God's grace experienced by Jeroboam. The same kind of pattern that's given to us in Psalm 103. O thou my soul, bless God the Lord. And then immediately goes to the spiritual arithmetic. God who's done this for you and done that for you and done that for you. And there's five elements that are used to sum up to him. Force the first verse of that psalm to bless the name of the Lord because he's done these things for you. Wave after wave of indebtedness of grace that comes upon us, that came upon Jeroboam's house. And then there comes that crucial little word, but. But you did this. But you have done evil above all that were before you. 14 and verse 9. A wicked response with a high hand and a hard heart. You have behaved in this cavalier spiritual way. Doing so in such a way that your name has now become a template. Your name has become an example, a touchstone. Your name has become something that's going to be used to be compared to many others who've come after you. You are going to be the touchstone. You're going to be the marker against which so many of your successors are going to be compared and contrasted. It wasn't something that they had drifted into. It wasn't something that had come upon them, as it were, without thinking about it. There was open defiance in what they had done. We're told that for me, you have put behind your back. You have put me, the end of verse 9, to provoke me to anger and cast me behind thy back. And the emphasis upon, but me, you have cast behind your back. The Lord is saying through his prophet to Jeroboam's wife, you don't want me in your face. You don't want me in your life. You don't want me in your mind. You don't want me in your days. You would much prefer to have a clean page to write your own wants and your own wishes. And that, in that open defiance, provokes the Lord. The same word provoking here is used of Peniel's behavior to barren Hannah at the beginning of 1 Samuel. There she was, a mother with plenty of children, and there was Hannah, barren. And every word that Peniel would speak was but salt in her wounds, belittling, ridiculing her. Look what the Lord has done for me, and where are your children? Here I am with a happy family, and where is yours? Provoking. The Lord speaks like this because the Lord is covenant God. He has set up that relationship between himself and his people, and wherever a third party intrudes into that relationship, the Lord has a right to be jealous. It is the proper reaction in that such relationship. If it was not there, then one has to question the basis of the relationship from the beginning. If someone is not jealous over the third party coming into a husband and wife relationship, then you've got to question the love of that relationship in the first place. Accusing her, accusing him, provoking the Lord because of that deliberate behavior, enticements and idolatry and such like that Jeroboam was importing to his own life and into the life of the nation, into the life of the people, a people who were God's covenant people. And by doing so, provoking the Lord. Accosted, accused. And then we have, thirdly, the announcement made. The Lord speaking not of the family, not of a few people, but the Lord speaking of the nation and all of the people. And he announces plain and bad news to them all. And he says, for your whole house, if you die in the city, the dogs are going to eat you. And if you die in the countryside, the birds are going to peck you. Whichever picture we want, it brings before us the shameful way of dying. No mourners, no carers, nobody around the body, just left there to decay in disgrace. He had to learn the hard way. Learn the hard way not to be presumptuous about the Lord. His approach was, we mentioned earlier on, being superstitious. We can add on to it. He was being presumptuous. He was favored once when Ahijah met him in chapter 11. But he cannot and he must not presume upon that a second time. God is not silent forever. His silence sometimes tries us, but God will speak and God will act sooner or later. And therefore we dare not trifle with a holy God and what a holy God has said. There is a healthy respect upon God's people which holds us back from such kind of brazen attitudes as Jeroboam and his wife demonstrate. But there was no such healthy fear, respect, and reverence with them. Same is seen today round about us, as heard on our streets, in our books, in our media. The name of God taken in vain, his name, character used at the butt of jokes and fun, his life, the lifestyle of so many people in defiance of what God has said. All of it without two thoughts of the God with whom they are dealing. And we need to be aware of the consequences. God may be silent for a little while, but God will speak. And when he speaks, then we need to be afraid. Crossing the line from the patience of God to his judgment. So we have the approach. We have the ambush. The third thing I want to draw attention to is the attestation that is given to us. At the end of verse 14, these little phrases, the Lord shall raise him up a king over Israel who shall cut off the house of Jeroboam that day. But what? Even now. It has now started. You've crossed that line from his patience, and the wheels of justice, which have been restrained for so long in the life of Jeroboam, the wheels of justice that have been held back for so long in God's dealings with them, now have been released, and they begin to turn. Can the Lord really mean all these things, we might say? Jeroboam's house, it's just started this new dynasty. It's just started. Will the Lord finish it so quickly? 210 years to run. No. It's only just words, isn't it? Surely there must be some other interpretation. Well, let's just listen and see. The attestation. Ahijah had severe and strong words of a message to give to the queen to take back to Jeroboam. And perhaps Jeroboam, not having heard them firsthand, might well be questioning, just like we've tried to illustrate there. And he was given this sure sign that everything is going to happen exactly like it said. As you enter the city, your son is going to die. Just as I said. There you have the, the first installment of the fearful package from the Lord. There you have the first thing happening that Ahijah had prophesied. And if that is going to happen, then all the rest will unfurl and unroll in due time and place. And it's all laid back and traced back to the door of Jeroboam. The first king did all the damage. And it takes 210 years for the consequences to run, to fall, and to be fulfilled upon the nation. One king condemned the whole nation. Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe has a clear policy of displacing and removing the white farmers from the land and giving it back to the African. But these Africans had little knowledge and experience about looking after animals or crops. And we find in Zimbabwe inflation running in hundreds of percentage, and the economy on the verge of being burst. All of it arising from one policy decision to take away the white farmers and to give the land back to the African. All because of the sins of Jeroboam. The Lord was going to dig up, shake loose, scatter, and abandon the nation, as he says in verse 15 here. And the refrain comes to us time and again. The refrain is there like an echo that comes back time after time after time. The echo comes haunting our thoughts. All because of Jeroboam, who sinned and caused Israel to sin. His name will be remembered forever for this reason. The attestation of what God had said. We must be prepared to take God at his word and to believe what he has said. For the Lord has spoken it, is what's told us at the end of verse 11. To believe what he has said. The essence of faith is to trust, to commit what the Lord has said. On Sunday we were thinking of the wedding garment and the way in which that man at the wedding feast discovered too late that he wasn't prepared. Discovered too late of the Lord God and what the Lord required of him. Same emphasis is given to us here. For so long and so far Jeroboam had defied the Lord, but now too late. After the death of his son, he realized who he was dealing with. God therefore is not mocked. The attestation that comes, the death of his son. And as that is the first package, all the rest will follow. The approach, the ambush, the attestation, the last thought, the last word, the assessment that is given to us here. A standard formula that is used to sum up his life. And the rest of the acts of Jeroboam, how he warred and how he reigned, behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel. What will be picked up in the assessment of our lives? Notice what is picked up in the assessment of importance in the life of Jeroboam. Oh, the wars and things like that. The rest of the acts, the rest of the things that he did. What were these rest of the things? Something as important as war. Now, war isn't a little thing involving a family. It's a thing that involves a nation. There's a lot at risk. And yet that is not what is highlighted and set before us in the assessment of the Scriptures by our God. It's frightening just how much is passed over and passed by God. And equally it's frightening what is picked up and set out by God. It's nothing comprehensive. It's not a complete assessment of his life. But instead there is a picking up of a spiritual thing which is far more important than wars and such like. And as we have that key, this spiritual dimension to his life, so we understand his place, his influence in history and the nation. Wars can be big things. We know the continuing discussion and place of the war in Iraq in the last 4 or 5 years in our nation and other nations. But according to what we're given in verse 19, that pales into insignificance over the spiritual damage which Jeroboam did. He's remembered not for his wars, but for his idolatry. The assessment that's made on his life. Our Lord speaks about a glass of water, something that's wholly insignificant perhaps in our mind, but that glass of water is what is noted and picked up on by God. Three simple things then as we close. First of all, Jeroboam, yet dead, still speaks. And he warns us of the deadly danger of idolatry and of shunning the word of the Lord. He warns us also about the influence that we have upon others. One man influencing so many and for so long. The ripples that spread out from his life to the borders of his nation, from Dan to Beersheba, the ripples of his life that come down through 4 or 5 dynasties over 210 years. The ripples that break upon the shores of so many others. Thirdly, let there be no doubt with us of something which is so often sidelined today, and people will put it by them or not even take it up at all. The message of judgment and of consequence of sin. It doesn't fit into the message that is preached today. It doesn't fit in with the emphasis people make today. This isn't the kind of gospel that people want to hear today. But God is saying to us that if we disdain, if we disregard what God says, there is a warning here from the life of Jeroboam of its consequences. If we take God on, if we challenge him as Jeroboam challenged him, and if we put our head up and our shoulders out and we say to ourselves, if not to others, does God see? Does God know? Then let us take the warning of the way in which Ahijah met his wife. Blind though he was, without any sensuous input for himself to recognize her, yet he knew her. Because the eyes of the Lord go over the earth, seeing all things. Therefore, when people say, does God see? We come back and we say, yes, God does see. and a warning is given to us from the life of Jeroboam. One thing out of his life, and with this I close. The one thing that really matters, the one thing that is set before us here, is the spiritual temperature and tone of his life. The question for ourselves, never mind anyone else, never mind Jeroboam, never mind anyone else about us, the question for us is, do we listen to, do we love, do we live for, and do we love the Lord our God? The questions that are important for us, and the way in which Jeroboam sets a contrast and challenges us where we are today. Amen.